Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. If you don't like the proposed Seattle head tax, how do you want the city to pay for low-income housing and services for homeless people? One Seattle business person will give you his alternative in just a few minutes. We're going to begin this hour with the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump has called it defective, horrible, rotten, and less than an hour ago, he withdrew from it.
We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States. America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail.
Here to tell you what you should understand about Trump's move is Professor Rashad Kasaba, head of the Jackson School of International Studies, University of Washington. Welcome, Professor.
Hello.
Here's part of why President Trump pulled out of this agreement in his words.
The fact is, this was a horrible one-sided deal that should have never, ever been made. It didn't bring calm, it didn't bring peace, and it never will.
Is Trump right, Professor? The Iran nuclear agreement has brought neither calm nor peace and never will?
Well, I think we have to see what the agreement aimed to do. This was an agreement not between U.S. and Iran, but that included all the permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany, European Union, and obviously Iran. It had a limited sort of purpose, which was to slow down and eventually eliminate Iran's move towards achieving, capability to produce nuclear weapons. It did not have as part of its terms, any kind of policy against Iran's foreign involvement, etc. Those were hoped that they would come about in time. In the time that the agreement was in effect, everybody agreed, people who were participating in inspections, that Iran was following the letter of the agreement, that it was following what it was supposed to do. So I don't think it's entirely accurate to call it a one-sided deal. What I'm afraid is that moving away from this treaty will isolate the United States even further in the international community. Just like it happened with the TPP, other countries will continue their arrangements and agreements. And whatever positive outcome that comes from these international agreements, the U.S. will not be able to benefit from them.
That gets to a question from a KUOW listener. B.D. Hampton writes, if America pulls out of the deal, yet the other nations that signed continue to support the deal, can it continue as is, or does the deal collapse without U.S. support?
I think it depends how hard the U.S. will put pressure on our European allies. President's statement was a little bit vague on that, and he said that if any country that helps Iran acquire nuclear weapons will face sanctions. I don't think any of the European powers are involved in helping Iran get European weapons. So if there is room there, if the U.S. does not put pressure, excess pressure on European allies, it is possible that Iran will continue its agreement with European Union and other members of the Security Council.
Just a couple more questions, Professor. The former Secretary of State under President Obama, John Kerry, who negotiated the Iran deal, spoke this morning before Trump's announcement.
We made an agreement. Iran is living by the agreement. Yes, we have concerns on the missiles, on Yemen, other things, but we should be working on those. The Obama administration made a clear decision that working on those other issues and making progress on them is easier with an Iran that doesn't have a nuclear weapon than an Iran which is moving towards one.
Does Trump's move mean Iran moves toward having a nuclear weapon?
Possibly. And what this likely will do is that it will strengthen the hands of the more conservative groups within Iran, groups that are not open to international engagement with treaties with the West or with the United States. That may, in fact, pave the way towards, restart of a nuclear weapons program. But as I said, it all depends on what happens between Iran and the other parties who are party to this agreement. And my expectation, and the Iranian government already made a statement, I think, that they will try and continue to their agreement with Europeans and with other allies. So that'll isolate the United States, and it'll make it more difficult for U.S. to enter any international agreement if, you know, somewhere down the line these agreements don't really mean much.
Finally, Professor, any special effect of withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal for those of us here in Washington State?
I know that some of the local companies like Boeing were have been involved in some preliminary deals with Iran. I would suspect that they will try to get some exemption from sanctions if that's possible at all, because otherwise, again, there are other companies in Europe who are equally very eager to get into the Iranian market. If the sanctions are really as sweeping as the president promised them to be, that will hurt local companies like Boeing in their international deals and competition with other companies.
So a huge open question is what kind of sanctions are we actually going to be talking about? So we'll watch that together. This is Professor Rashad Kassaba, head of the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have a response this morning from Seattle Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who says, quote, Donald Trump's decision today moves us closer to war with Iran. We'll keep following the developments with you right here on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back with The Record in a moment. Some businesses are pushing back on the Seattle City Council's proposed employee head tax to pay for affordable housing and social services. Is there a better way to solve the city's affordability crisis? I spoke to Saul Spady of the Dick's Drive-In Spady family. Saul's not in the hamburger business himself. He heads an ad agency called Creative Empowerment. But Saul explained why he and some other local businesses in the city oppose this employee head tax.
We're a little discouraged by the city's ability to spend its money wisely. I mean, we could say the Seattle streetcar, or we could say bike paths. And I think we all kind of have a perspective that the city promises a lot and delivers very little sometimes.
And would you say the same about the city's progress on homelessness?
I would say the city has doubled its spending and homelessness has increased in that time period. Previously, the 10-year plan to end homelessness didn't make a dent and ended up being incredibly inflexible when we saw a great rise in family homelessness during the recession, because we were, of course, in the middle of the 10-year plan to end homelessness, and you couldn't change that. And so, yeah, I think the city leaves a lot to be desired. You know, I'll make a great example of I worked when I was on the board of Mary's Place on a program called No Child Sleeps Outside that we drove forward with Dick's Drive-Ins, where we got business communities to support Mary's Place to try to build that emergency family shelter that the 10-year plan to end homelessness didn't have revenue for. And we were able to, in the last 4 years, go from 100 to 700 shelter beds. And Mary's Place has gone to about, I think, like $5 to $8 million a year charity. And, you know, 700 shelter beds for $8 million a year is a good investment. And then the city comes along and they say they need $75 million a year. And I know it's going to go to a couple different things, but we're going to get 360 emergency shelter beds at the end of 5 years of $75 million a year. I think it's really fair for the business community to say, hey, you've doubled spending in 2 years and haven't made progress. Let's think of a wiser way to do this.
What is your alternative that Dick's Drive-In and some others are supporting?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you had a chance to read it, there was an op-ed written by my sister, the vice president of Dick's Drive-In, alongside Howard S. Wright and Rachel of Rachel's Ginger Beer. And they proposed doing tax credits. So not saying, you know, if you're going to do this tax and we need this $75 million, let's let the business community, these 600, you know, business owners who know how to make a dollar go a mile, and let them directly invest that into the city-approved charities, as well as maybe donate land the way that Amazon did for Mary's Place. I have a hard time believing that, you know, the city can build five stories of co-housing at a cheaper rate than Amazon can into its buildings. And instead of seeing Amazon stop building a tower, let's see them build four more towers with four more stories of co-housing for different shelters.
What does Amazon say about that?
I can't speak for Amazon, but I can definitely say that Amazon is extremely proud to support Mary's Place. I think they're really grateful to be able to give Fair Start free rental space to run their restaurants and help people get out of homelessness. I bet you Amazon would much rather build buildings where they donate a couple floors and help an organization like Mary's Place and really see those dollars go a long way than give $20 million to the city of Seattle and see them get lost in a bureaucratic bog.
So are you saying in return for a city council no vote on this head tax, you would present a promise from a list of local businesses that would guarantee they'll voluntarily going to?
I'm not saying that at all.
So how would we?
So Mike O'Brien got really caught up in this fact. They're lawmakers. Lawmakers can make laws. I'm saying you can look at other cities that have done tax credits, do a tax credit. Let's say if you're given a $20 million tax bill, Amazon will then have to have donated $20 million worth of land, services, and cash. And if I did it correctly, I'd do a one-to-one rate because I believe that these charities are going to be significantly more effective with this money than City Hall will be. And so I guess the compromise here isn't saying let the businesses do it out of the goodness of their heart. And I'll go on a fact saying I don't think a jobs tax is a good idea in the city. But I really don't think giving $75 million to a City Hall that has shown itself ineffective to being fair to budgets and results is a good idea.
In the bigger picture here, Saul, the city council estimates that Amazon will pay about $20 million a year if this head tax went through. The company, of course, makes much more than that in profit in Amazon's case. Why shouldn't some of these big companies pay more to help the city cope with the growth they are causing?
One, growth is not a bad thing. Growth is actually very important. It allows us all to have jobs because there's a lot of people here. Millennials who have a hard time affording to live in the city can drive Ubers, or we can, you know, sometimes if we break rules, rent our apartments out on Airbnb. I think we have to ask a little more serious questions like, why don't we have drug treatment for everyone who wants it? Why is it harder to build emergency shelter and get it available quickly to the people who need it? We definitely need mental health services. And honestly, when I go to like high density housing, having the city be a partner in letting developers build it instead of just saying that only the city has a right to do that. You know, like let's take Dick's, for example. It's a high volume, low margin business. If you make us pay more for our employees, we're going to have to choose between a more efficient workforce, whether we stay in the city of Seattle, or whether we give to philanthropy. And I guess the question for everyone in the city of Seattle to ask ourselves on the head tax is, do we trust the city to spend this money efficiently? And I think the reason you're seeing people, regular citizens, rise up and start acting very similarly to how a council member has acted for the last 4 years, they're angry and they don't see a city council that's accountable in any way. But, you know, maybe we'll see the answer in 2019 when six of them are up for vote.
Saul Spady, president of Creative Empowerment, a local ad agency that represents Dick's Drive-In. You may recognize his name as the grandson of Dick's co-founder, Dick Spady. Do you have questions about Seattle's proposed head tax? If so, send us an email, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. We'll get that to our newsroom and see if we can get you an answer. Saul Spady, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful to be here.
So you just heard Saul Spady's alternative to a proposed Seattle employee head tax. Instead of taxing big Seattle businesses on the jobs they create, give those businesses a tax credit for donating directly to charities that serve the homeless, a tax credit for building low-income housing. That way you don't discourage businesses from hiring and you don't waste the money in a big city bureaucracy. Is that a better idea? Let's ask Professor Jacob Vigdor now, public policy professor, University of Washington. He studies this stuff. Professor, what do you think of that idea? Let the private sector donate money more efficiently.
Well, I think you go back to something that Sam said in that interview about spending the money more wisely. And I think that there's a case to be made that we need to take a hard look in this city about whether we're spending money wisely. I think back, Bob Haban wrote a book a couple decades ago called Hard Head, Soft Heart. And the idea was we should have compassion for people who need our assistance, but we need to be very hard-headed and analytical about whether we're doing that in the best way. I am a little bit skeptical of the notion that you could have businesses just sort of donating wherever they thought was a good place to put their money and have that result in greater wisdom in spending and greater effectiveness.
Why not? You heard his argument. It's a big city bureaucracy. They're inefficient. They haven't spent the money well so far.
Yeah, and if you're sort of a free market kind of person, you might think, well, the magic of the marketplace will sort of avoid all these problems. I'm not so sure. I have to say that I think, you know, what we want is we want to have a system where we're looking at data and we're thinking very carefully about, has a particular program or a particular service demonstrated itself to be effective? And I think that having a centralized approach makes sense for that. I think that it's fair to say that the centralized approach we currently have is not doing all that great. But I don't think we want to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
So you think it would be too uncoordinated for a bunch of different businesses to donate directly to a bunch of different charities and get tax credits for it? The city can be, you believe in the city, that the city can be more coordinated, more targeted, more efficient?
I think that we need to demand as citizens that our government, and it's not just the city of Seattle's problem, this is a regional problem.
Yeah.
So we need to demand a more coordinated, more analytical approach to the problem. I think the degree to which our approach is not coordinated between Seattle and King County and some of the other government agencies, that's part of the problem. And sort of going more decentralized in terms of having lots of different businesses decide, make their own individual decisions, I don't know that that's going to be an effective approach to the problem.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about the alternative, the proposed head tax. Before I get there, do you even think the city needs more money to solve the housing and affordability and homeless problem?
I think there's a pretty good case to be made that the city could be doing a better job of spending current resources more wisely. But then take that to the logical extreme. Suppose that we are spending each of the dollars we have as wisely as possible. Does that solve the problem? I think it's reasonable to conclude that we may very well need more money if we're going to completely solve this problem.
Yeah, depending on how we define the problem. And that's a separate conversation.
Sure.
But we're talking about tax policy in a way now. And I want to know what you think of the alternative, which is a head tax on every employee of big grossing Seattle businesses.
I think there's a motivation for this, which is to say these businesses are profitable. They have grown, and in their growth, they have contributed to these problems. Now, the trouble I have with the tax is that it's not a tax on profits. It's a tax on employment. The more that you spend in payroll, the greater your tax bill will be. It isn't really designed to be a tax on businesses, and it gives businesses a pretty easy way to avoid the tax, which is just to say, I'm going to cut back on my employment in the city, or I'm going to take other types of actions that allow me to evade this tax. Local governments, most of American history, have relied on one tax more than any other. It's the property tax, for the simple reason that property can't get up and walk away. Jobs can't.
But listeners' heads can explode who are complaining about the already high property tax burden on them. We hear from them all the time right here on this show.
And I think that's a big part of the political story of why the city is looking for other sources of revenue here. I think there is a general sense that we are kind of getting tired of these tax increases, some of which are coming from the state and not any kind of local government. So the employee hours tax is a tax that the city council could pass without going to the voters. And I think that explains part of its appeal.
Finally, would you advocate, as a professor of public policy, would you advocate some kind of profit tax, some kind of income tax?
I think if of all the problems that we have with taxation in Washington State, the lack of income taxation is number one. And I think that if you wanted to take a longer run view of this and ask the question, how do we put ourselves on the pathway to the best Washington State, you have to be thinking of a pathway to address the lack of an income tax. And I worry that what we're doing in Seattle right now is sort of agitating an anti-tax coalition that could come back to haunt us in the future.
But what if that income tax sends companies like Amazon somewhere else, HQ2?
Well, last time I checked, a lot of those HQ2 finalists have income taxes of their own. So I don't know that it's they're not just focusing on Texas and Tennessee and the states without income taxes. Last time I checked, Massachusetts has one, Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina. You know, we can compete in other ways.
Okay, we'll see how that goes. Professor Jacob Vigdor teaches public policy, studies these tax policy questions at the University of Washington. Thanks a lot, Professor.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we're continuing to follow the head tax, homelessness, affordability in Seattle. So what question do you have about these issues? Email us. You ask, we answer. The email address is record@kuow.org. Again, record@kuow.org. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. There's an informal rule on my kids' school playground. You can't keep secrets. I don't know whether that rule came from the teachers or the kids, but they're very clear. Keeping secrets is tempting and common, and it's not nice. My next guest's 10-year-old daughter has a secret. Only her daughter's most trusted friends knew it until one of those friends spilled the beans. Marlo Mack's daughter is transgender, and she's trying to protect her daughter in a world that might not understand. Marlo, good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Host of the podcast, How to Be a Girl. Marlo, your daughter is, as you say, stealth. She's not out to her classmates about her gender identity.
Right, or undisclosed is kind of what we're saying now.
Oh, undisclosed.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, it's a decision that I let her make. I think she's afraid of being bullied or teased, probably, unfortunately, rightly so. And more than that, I think she's afraid of just being seen as different. She just wants to be another little girl on the playground. Mm. And as far as most of the people at school know, that's what she is.
You made an uncomfortable phone call to the mother of the girl, the friend of your daughter who spread the word about your daughter being transgender. What did you and this mother say to one another?
Well, I have to say that the little girl only did tell a couple other little girls, and I think it could have been a fairly innocent thing. I think it's a bit above a 10-year-old's pay grade to keep any secret, let alone maybe such an interesting one.
And that's hard for adults.
I think, as we have found, parents like me, the mothers, the parents, not just the mothers, but I've had the experience of being talked about as well, by other parents. But with this mother, you know, she was devastated. She had known that my daughter was transgender. She was surprised that her daughter spilled the information, and I think ultimately the little girl did apologize, and they really did the right thing, and we all learned a lot. But it was a scary couple of days, wondering if all of a sudden the entire school would know.
Yes, I shouldn't actually have said spread the word. You're right. She just, you know, she mentioned it to a couple friends, and so far still, it hasn't spread further?
So far, so good, okay. As far as we know.
Your daughter doesn't seem angry at her friend. She asked you to stop caring about it so much. Can you stop caring about it so much?
I'm trying. I think it's easier for her in some ways. Although she's quite young, I don't think she realizes what could go wrong or if she loses her privacy now, how that might impact her in middle school and high school. So I'm the one kind of looking down the pike going, you know, is it wise to be really open now? Will she regret that? We talk about it a lot. We're really not sure how we'll handle it in the future, if we'll stay more quiet or she might be more out and proud.
Deep down, Marlo, how long do you expect people, the whole school, not to know about your daughter's gender identity?
I would say if one kid knows, before long, or ultimately the whole school will know. I think that you kind of have to live with that, face that reality.
I'm talking with Marlo Mack, producer of the How to Be a Girl podcast, season 2, just out on iTunes. And also here with us in the studio, Tiffany Kelly. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi.
Your son has been out, but he's about to start middle school. And are you deciding whether to, what decision are you making as your son goes into middle school?
It is a fine line between, you know, letting him know that it's not always going to be undisclosed, whether he would like that or not. You know, especially with the middle school, you have different schools that feed into that. One kid knows, you have to assume that that's, you know, going to travel. And so we've had a lot of hard conversations about, you know, understanding that he might not want to share that, and that's fine, that's private information. But it's not a secret. Secrets are, you know, scary and forbidden. And
well, I use the word secret, but you make a distinction with your kids, but you don't call it a secret. What do you mean?
Just that, you know, a secret tends to have the connotation of, you know, something bad or scary. And I really want, you know, him to know, first of all, how, you know, proud we are of him, that this, you know, bravery and strength that he's shown from such a young age, or all these kids, really. I mean,
we tend to use the word private among in our community. It's not a secret, but it's private, sort of like any private medical information.
Exactly.
Well, how do your kids, I actually hadn't thought of a secret as being negative. I remember I would have a secret about which, you know, what girl, in my case, what girl I liked, or all kinds of secrets. I mean, how do you know your child won't in some way take this privacy as this is something I should be secretive about or even ashamed of?
Right. I mean, maybe it's, in a way, it's semantics for the parents to make ourselves feel better, I suppose. Yes, I mean, that's the line we're walking, is how do you say, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, there's nothing shameful, but don't tell anyone. You know, how do you do that? And we work hard. We walk a tricky line. And it would be nice to say, look, this is Seattle, this is the West Coast, Blue State. You know, I have a lot of people saying secrets are bad, secrets are toxic, let your kid be out. Why would you have her be stealth? But unfortunately, we hear stories from our good friends right here in this community all the time that are hard to believe about how badly sometimes these kids are being treated when they are out as trans, bullied by other parents or staff at the school who don't know, really understand the issue. So unfortunately, it's not as safe and happy and to be an out trans kid in this world yet. So the fears are well-founded, I'm afraid.
Tiffany, how do you think your son, your 11-year-old, takes that question of this is nothing to be ashamed of and don't tell anyone?
He is, you know, would definitely like to, I guess, say, you know, not talk about it. And that's just not realistic. And again, you know, going back to, I'm not saying, you know, he deserves to be keeper of his truth. But I've also really tried to, you know, have the conversation with him of, I want you to have happy, healthy, communication-filled relationships, whether it's with friends or romantic partners in the future, way in the future. And that, you know, I want to hopefully lay that foundation of, you know, that's absolutely fine if that's not something that you, you know, want as part of your introduction. There's lots of things about, you know, all of us that we don't include as part of our introduction to people and to the world. However, you know, it is part of who he is, and you know, I want that to be incorporated in how he approaches the world.
I'd like to ask you both the question that I could understand. First of all, other parents might have this question, and you might think it's a rude question, but I hope I can ask,
go
and you can
it.
Tell me
Absolutely.
What you think.
We've probably
Which,
heard it.
Exactly.
Okay, yes, I'm sure you've heard it.
A lot.
Okay, because you were joking about, you know, other relationships in the future, way in the future, I hope. That's a joke all parents make, right?
Sure.
Does any part of you still wonder or hope as to whether this is, quote unquote, just a phase, or are you past that?
Well, you have kids, right?
I have kids.
Yeah. Are they over 7?
They're over 7.
So I would ask you the same question, and it would sort of seem, it would land the same way. Kids, you know, gender identity development, we, you know, psychologists have known for decades, occurs far earlier than sexual orientation comes into play. And I think the two often get conflated, and that's where there's a lot of confusion. But young children, I mean, what kindergartner doesn't know their gender? So no parent of a cisgender child, which is non-transgender, would ask that of themselves, or any, you know, would expect to be asked that. And we feel the same way, because we've seen the same trajectory in our kids. We've seen children who, yes, they have anatomy that's unexpected for the gender that they identify with, but in every other way, from the moment my daughter could talk, and I think the same is true of Tiffany's son, essentially said, this is who I am. And so it would be as bizarre to me if she changed her gender as any other child that any of the listeners know.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that, you know, in all honesty and fairness, every parent at the beginning of this life, you know, does ask themselves, is it just a phase? Especially, you know, for us, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was not as much information, not as many, you know, families sharing their stories. And so it felt even scarier. And, you know, now looking back, I just shake my head. You know, phases don't last years. Yeah. But also, I've, you know, I've lived with this amazing boy.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea how long you want your kids to be private about their gender identity? Is it just unknowable? Is it play it by ear? Or do you have a plan?
Well, I really want it to be up to her. My primary goal is that she's in charge, but that she has information that's age appropriate to make the decisions at each stage. And, you know, there's just no book on how you do that right. So we're making it up every day, every school year, every month.
Do you have an idea of any age that would be too longer than you want this to stay private?
I mean, I guess I feel, you know, undisclosed is
undisclosed.
Such a vague term that, you know, my son is, you know, he transitioned at the elementary school that he is at. So he's not undisclosed, but it's also been so long that I bet many people have forgotten.
That's quite a statement right there, that many people have forgotten. Yep. That might not be obvious to everyone sure. listening, that could be... It could be no big deal.
Little kids don't care. Just the parents. It's
exactly.
Little kids, they kindergartners up through fourth grade, I think they think it's a really uninteresting detail most of the time. But the parents think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. The parent of three cisgender kids, as far as I know, right? They, it's just not a big deal. I bought them a book, you know, about a transgender child. And, you know, it's just one of a million books and... It's just not a big
Great.
Deal.
Good job.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Because those are the things that make a difference, that it is just part of the conversation that we're having. And it's a conversation that benefits all kids, that, you know, the message really is who you say you are is who I love and respect. And that's kind of all it is. So
who you say you are is who I love and respect.
Yeah.
This is Tiffany Kelly and Marlo Mack. Thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you so much.
And again, season two of Marlo's podcast, How to Be a Girl, is out now on iTunes. Tiffany Kelly is the subject of a film you can see at Seattle International Film Festival, The Most Dangerous Year.
Yes. Our mutual friend Vlada is a filmmaker and realized the importance of telling the story of the bathroom bills that we're attempting to get passed here in our liberal blue state, and the work we did to fight that and educate. And I'm just so excited for her. And
it's an amazing film.
Really hope that it gets an audience.
Starting here in what, a couple of weeks?
At the film festival.
May 29th and June 2nd.
Uh-huh. Tiffany Kelly, Marlo Mack, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, back in just a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke.
So we're going to have a conversation that's a very black conversation about blackity blackness.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so how do you hope other KUOW listeners hear this?
I would say buckle up.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be okay. Listen and learn.
That's Seattle poet Imani Sims and Carvel Wallace hosted the podcast Closer Than They Appear, and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Imani wrote a poem inspired by one moment in the film Black Panther. She writes about the way that people of color are asked to perform race in white spaces, spaces like public radio. Carvel was in town last week for a conversation with artist Sandra Perry as part of the Seattle Art Museum's Figuring History exhibit, so we brought them together for a conversation about blackness within Seattle city limits. Here's the poem read by Seattle civic poet Anastasia Renee Tolbert. It's called Better Than Captivity.
What is it to know the cliff inside out? Rewound tapes, discard, unbow the knees, pray upright at the sun. Greet the open, surrender, inhale hummingbird hymns, play without apology. Loosened hips in red silk, we have become our ancestors' whisper against the constellation sky. Unleash God from ribs, spill out into today, a song locked on taste buds. Key the self into timeless abundance. Watch the spill on pavement spread black within city limits.
Tell me about this cliff, to know the cliff inside and out. Why is that an image?
Why the cliff?
Why the cliff?
So I'm going to go all the way back to Black Panther. Killmonger and T'Challa are on the cliff, and T'Challa's letting Killmonger see the land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
the
right,
Wakanda sunset,
yes,
which he's never seen.
Yes. Yeah,
even though it's his homeland.
He's talking about, we can still bring you back and heal you. And Killmonger's like, why? So you can cage me, bury me with my ancestors. And it struck me that a black man would choose to die over being captive for the rest of his life. And I was like, whoa. So what is it to know that moment inside out? What is it to know that choice, to know that there are so many of our ancestors buried in the oceans who chose that version of freedom? And so I wanted to capture that image of choosing death over captivity immediately. And that was the image that I had when I wrote that first line.
Why did that image speak to you?
I think because I recognized the honor in dying over being kept a slave, being kept against my own will. I feel like at times I'm captive to my own skin. I'm seeing black first, not a poet, not queer, not a woman. I am black above everything, every other identifier I have. And I think that in that moment, I knew how important it would be for me to die free. If things go haywire and we get bought out and they're enslaving black people again, I guarantee you, I bury me with my ancestors. I don't want to not live free. That doesn't sound appealing to me at all.
Well, in some ways, this goes back to even before the blank hits the fan and people are getting enslaved again, which is now a threat that we all, I mean, I have this theory that everyone wakes up thinking of the end of the world, thinking of, yeah, the apocalypse, that's everyone just kind of, you know, I mean, we're like, oh, like Walgreens is out of lotion. Also, will I need lotion if the apocalypse happens? You know, like that's kind of like what this time is about.
Yeah.
But presuming that society will go on in some iteration of itself, which who knows, this question of dying free really feels to me like it has to do more with the willingness,
mm-hmm,
right? Because the captivity that we talked about is what you talked about before, to be trapped inside the skin, mm-hmm, to be trapped in the way that people see you, mm-hmm, to be trapped in always having to live this black identity in a white space, and then, mm-hmm, all the stuff that comes with it, to explain, to put up borders, to put up walls, to deal with microaggressions, to deal with macroaggressions, and all that. And so we then are captive to that. And, mm-hmm, so what is the alternative? And I know for me growing up, especially because I spent some years of my life as the only black person in an all-white small town in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm, in the 80s, when I was hitting puberty, it was not a good situation.
Yeah.
I can tell you that for sure. And what I learned about myself when I look back on that is that my fear of owning my blackness came with an existential threat.
Mm-hmm.
That was never spoken. No classmate was ever like, look, if you're too black, we're going to kill you.
Right.
But that was felt.
Yeah.
That was enforced very slowly, but very seriously in every single context that I went through.
Yeah.
And then when I was an adult, and then the proof started showing up that was the case, the, mm-hmm, visual proof, mm-hmm, starting with in the 90s with Amadou Diallo, with Patrick Dorsma, and then moving on that was the existential threat.
Yeah.
And what I hear you talking about is the willingness to face that. I would rather be fully inhabited,
mm-hmm,
and willing to die than to live in captivity around this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That is such a provocative image.
Yeah.
To know the cliff inside and out.
Yeah.
Or inside out is that actually what you write.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that. Killmonger has this argument,
uh-huh,
that Wakanda,
mm-hmm,
isn't as dope as Wakanda thinks it is, mm-hmm, because the rest of the diaspora is suffering,
mm-hmm,
and Wakanda was just there with all this crazy technology not helping.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, so I not only is Wakanda now like canceled, I'm also going to take over Wakanda and do what they should have did a long time ago to stop this diaspora from suffering in the way it did. And the counter argument to that is that Wakanda's like, yeah, okay, like we could have gone out and taken on the whole world because we would just be colonized as well.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder about this question of, is it possible to attain individual freedom or individual liberation in a context in which there's suffering across the diaspora, however you define that?
Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, that's the only liberation that we're afforded. I think that the system does a really great job of keeping us in check. And so I think that's why I use limits as a container for Blackness, because I think that as long as Blackness exists as a cultural other, we're still going to have to work within white limitations. And so the only real freedom we can ever really experience is our own definition of freedom, is liberating our own selves into a safer place. I think being free is really dependent on dismantling the system. Otherwise, we'll continue to be enslaved by capitalism and the patriarchy and whatever else the white colonizer can dream up to keep us in check with. The overarching powers have to change. The balance needs to shift in order for that to happen. So while I think it would be great if we had Wakandan technology, I'm not sure what we would do with it if we did have it. Do we then become the colonizer because we have the technology to do so?
Do you think it's possible for Black people in America to have freedom and also for white people in America to have freedom?
No. No. White people are going to need their own little island.
Oh, shit.
Like, I think...
Oh my God.
I think
Yo. Okay.
I think there's so much PTSD around Blackness and whiteness that we're going to need to be separate for a while, I think. And for a time, until they get used to not having the amount of privilege that they have, I think that violence would ensue. And I wouldn't.
Well, it already had. I mean, that is indeed where we're at. That is what
violence.
This is. This is a violent response to the very notion or idea of Black folks gaining an increased measure of freedom or liberty.
Yes.
And that's enough to make people like take arms and take to the streets.
Yes. So we're going to have to exist in separate places. Historically, we have a really violent relationship with whiteness. The children of the diaspora have a really violent relationship with whiteness. They stole us. We were minding our own business in our own countries on one of the wealthiest continents in the world. And they just decided it was theirs, like 2-year-olds. We need to be separate for a while and like figure out what it is to be Black without this structure of power over us, because then who do we become? What do we become, right? When we're so far detached from where our heartbeat came from, who do we become? Who are we?
Yeah.
And I think we would need to figure that out first.
I'm Carvell Wallace, host of the podcast Closer Than They Appear and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. And I'm here with Seattle poet Imani Sims. I often wonder why it is that we do this. On a podcast I did last year for Al Jazeera, I interviewed a guy who was a Muslim doctor in a small town in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the town physician, like this small town, and it was all good. And then November 9th, 2016 happened, and he found out that half his county voted for the current president. And the next day he was like, what is this? I'm like examining you and you're voting for, like, you know.
Yeah.
And so what he ended up doing was he realized that all these people had all these crazy misconceptions about Islam.
Wow.
And so he started going around to these small towns and literally holding seminars to educate people about Islam.
Wow.
And I was like, but why? Like, why do you expose yourself to this? I mean, this is noble, but he walks into a room and someone's like, yes, I have a question. Aren't you the devil? You know what I mean? And I'm like, yo, why do you sign up for this?
Yeah.
And ever since then, I've been curious about this question of why do we communicate?
Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's a really big deal for me to show up as my full self. If they don't ever ever experience another Black person in their life, which is easy to do in Seattle. I wanted them to know that I am here. We exist. And if I'm going to do this thing, if I'm going to have a platform, I'm going to use it to like shift some things. Otherwise, why do we do anything? It doesn't feel authentic for me to communicate my story and only tailor that to the Black community. I think that I would be doing a disservice if I didn't get white people together. Because like...
Right. Is that exhausting?
Yes.
To have that work, to that... Last night, a conversation that came up between some people and I was the phrase hypervisibility. It's the idea that you're super visible as a Black person in a white space. And that means two things. One is that everyone sees you and yet no one sees you. They see what you represent. You become a very big projection screen upon which they reflect whatever's in their brain. That's kind of like the Ralph Ellison Invisible Man idea. Tell me, is that exhausting to you? What does that feel like?
It is exhausting. I think a lot of times I feel like I'm the lone Black representative in a white space, and that I do then become whatever imaginings they have of a Black woman. And on top of that, I have the audacity to be queer. So that literally explodes into a myriad of, you know, rainbows and fists and whatever else they imagine my culture is. And so, yeah, I'm often tired, which means I take a lot of naps.
You know, I was thinking, weirdly, this trip to Seattle, I've almost only talked to Black people, which is like so bizarre. It's just a bizarre thing to have happened in Seattle. It's like weird, but that's the way it's unfolded. And it's been kind of amazing, right? And so I was thinking about how good that feels. And then I was immediately, because I also grew up around white people, I immediately... the counter argument popped into my head that was like, well, that's segregation. And if you do that, I'm going to do that. I'm only going to be around white people, blah, blah, blah. And so, and I was like, I was thinking about this idea, how, you know, our public expression of love for Blackness, our public expression of the need to be around Black folks has been in a lot of ways co-opted, misunderstood, maybe perhaps willfully, I would argue, misunderstood and then used to justify this kind of like advancing of an identity politics that is destructive. How do you respond to that idea that, that well, if you're going to segregate, then we're going to segregate? And, you know, I thought Martin Luther King said, see no color or whatever, you know, whatever people's response is.
I actually don't mind being in all Black spaces and sort of avoiding white folks. I don't mind it. But I also want the clarity around, just because we are pro-Black also doesn't mean that we are anti-white.
I do notice that over the past however many years, it feels to me that there has been a willful co-opting of identity politics to justify, at least linguistically, this new formation of white racism, this latest formation of white racism. I don't want to call it new. And I wonder what responsibility you feel like we as Black people have to that. These people are out here marching in the streets and building up their whole shtick, and who knows how far it's going to go. And we're like, white people, gather your people, like, come get your folks. But what if they don't?
What happens when they don't gather their people?
And what is our responsibility there?
I don't think that we are responsible. I think that's sort of the iteration of Blackness that we need to be in. I'm sort of going way back to Black nationalism and like, if we can't exist within a nation that hates us, then we need to build our own nation. They don't have a choice at this point. Like, we have proven over and over that we can protest in the streets and still the power lies in the hands of white folks. So if you are an awake white person, I'm sure you have a racist auntie, uncle, somebody who's got privilege and power and can flex those muscles to make some change, because we ultimately, the system doesn't serve us. So our responsibility is to keep telling white people to get their people and keep living our best lives as best we can, and to nurture our community.
we've got to have a safe place to go. And I think first and foremost, that's what we should be doing, is creating safe spaces for Black people to go.
So we're, you and I are having this conversation, but we're having it on NPR. We're doing a performance of Blackness in a White Space.
Yes.
How do you navigate that? How do you square that circle?
I think I love that we've been able to be as Black as we are in a very white space.
Yeah.
It's sort of like glitter. You just sprinkle a little bit and just deposit it in places just so they'll find it later.
Yeah.
I love that it's like a sneak attack.
I love it. I'm so happy that I had an opportunity to talk with you.
It's been until late.
It's always wonderful to connect with other folks. And so thank you for coming out.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, appreciate it.
That was Carvell Wallace in conversation with Imani Sims. Carvell is the host of the podcast Closer Than They Appear, contributing writer to New York Times Magazine. Imani is a Seattle poet and educator, and she's a KUOW news poet. We invite Pacific Northwest poets to write an original piece inspired by a KUOW news story. I'm Bill Radke. That's our show today. The Record is produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brenpong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, writer and humorist Gary Steingart. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.